The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio. Two cousins have a dream to travel west with a wagon train of supplies and make a fortune in trade. Preacher needs a job and is heading west anyway. But he doesn't bargain on the beautiful woman who sneaks her way into the wagon train and the trouble she brings on board. And before he can wash his hands of the whole bunch, he's suddenly in a fight for his life.
Everybody inside the wagons, make sure that anything that might blow away is tied down. And once storm hits, keep your head down.
Good God, though. It's like being in a damn river.
Rise and shine. Indians have come to call.
Indians?
Engines? Did you say engines, Preacher?
Yeah, about a dozen of them sitting a couple of hundred yards away watching us.
Are they going to attack?
It's too soon to tell.
Kill them! Kill all the savage bastards!
The first thing is to get around that wagon train and move on ahead of it. Once we've done that, we can find a suitable spot for a trap. As many rifles as we've got, we ought to be able to kill all of them in one volley.
Preacher's mine.
No, Preacher's too dangerous to take any chances. Anyone who has a good shot at him, take it. I want that son of a bitch dead as soon as possible when we hit the wagon train.
Turn around! Get the hell out of here! Leave the wagon! Get out of the canyon!
Die, you bastard!
Preacher!
Don't miss the wagon train to adventure. Saddle up for the first Mounted Man 14, Preacher's Showdown. Available now from Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Justice League of America, Wonder Woman, Mythos.
When Hermione and Chloe read to you out of the ancient text, daughter, did they ever read you a story about an island of men?
You really think there is an island of warriors in this ocean?
Oracle?
Batman, something big just came up. I mean that literally. An island just popped up out of nowhere.
Magic.
I hate magic.
Tonight, we set sail for Themyscira, where our weapons will taste blood.
Superman, you are possessed by Ares.
You ruined everything.
Who the hell died and made you queen, huh?
Come, Diana, puppet of Ares. One of us must die now.
I'm sorry, Mother.
Kill her!
No!
Now the world will burn.
Copyright 2009, DC Comics, all rights reserved. Justice League of America, Wonder Woman, and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 14. The Golden Elephant. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Lily Beacon, Tony Nam, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Kate Foster, Jeff Baker, and Mort Shelby.
The Legend.
The English commander took Joan's sword and raised it high. The broadsword, plain and unadorned, gleamed in the firelight. He put the tip against the ground and his foot at the center of the blade. The broadsword shattered, fragments falling into the mud. The commander tossed the hilt deep into the crowd. Smoke almost obscured Joan, but she continued praying till the end, until finally the flames climbed her body and she sagged against the restraints. Joan of Arc died that fateful day in France, but her legend and her sword are reborn. Anya Creed felt something give beneath the cleated heel of her Red Wing walking shoe.
Oops.
The floor of the passageway was caked inches thick in dust. Anya couldn't see the trigger. She had sensed it more than heard it. Already in motion, Anya dove for the floor. Catching herself on her hands, Anya looked around by the light of her bulky hand lantern, which lay several feet ahead of her. She spotted three bronze spears spanning the 2-yard-wide corridor a yard above the floor. They were meant to impale any unwary intruder, including, of course, her.
Emperor Lu sure was paranoid.
Cautiously, Anya wiggled forward. As her weight came off the hidden floor plate, the spears began to retract into the walls. By the time she reached her lantern, they had vanished. The stone plates that covered the ports through which the spears had thrust out swung back into place. Waving aside the swirling dust, Anya sat up and shone her light on the walls. She could see no sign of where the spears had come from. The walls had been painted with some kind of murals that had faded to mere swirls and suggestions of faint color. They still worked to camouflage the trap, though. She shook her head and picked herself up.
Gotta move.
Anya dusted off the front of her tan shirt and khaki cargo pants. This would be her only shot. With the construction of a giant dam nearby, the floodwaters were rising. By tomorrow, they would make the subterranean tunnels unsafe. With redoubled caution, she made her way deeper into the Mad Emperor's lost tomb. The passageway air was cool and dry and smelled of stone and earth. Some indeterminate distance down, after several bends and a couple of doglegs, the corridor leveled. Far down the hallway, in which she could just stand upright, Anya saw that something was blocking the way.
Could that be the door to Lu's actual tomb?
Her heartbeat quickened. According to the ground-penetrating radar scans, it could be. The last Chinese team to come down here had intended to open the bronze door to the burial chamber proper. She had no idea whether they had or not. The Beijing University officials who had hired Anya suggested that they felt the last team had indeed made some major discoveries and had then departed by some currently unknown entrance to the Great Mound before vanishing. She was being asked to play archaeology cop, to find out if the tomb had been plundered and, if possible, to trace the thieves. Now, something about the place bothered her. Anya flashed her light down the corridor. She thought she saw a hint of green from the obstruction, the classic color of the patina on bronze doors. The copper in the alloy turned green as it oxidized.
I wonder if I should have looked more closely for bloodstains around those spear traps.
As she moved forward toward the door, she became aware of a strange smell. A bad smell, and all too familiar. The stench of death. It grew stronger as she approached the door. The floor tipped abruptly beneath her, and she dropped straight down. Without thought, she formed her right hand into a fist. The legendary blade of Joan of Arc filled her hand. She thrust the sword to her left. 8 inches of the broadsword's tip was wedged into the wall of the pit. Grabbing the hilt with her left hand as well, Anya clung desperately and looked down. The earlier hint of scent had become a foul, enveloping cloud. The floor trap was hinged longitudinally along the center. The pit was 20 feet long and sank at least 12 feet deep. Bronze spearheads jutted up from the floor like snaggled green teeth. Entangled and impaled among them, almost directly below her, lay a number of bodies. She couldn't tell exactly how many. They had become tangled together as they fell onto the spears. The glare of her lantern turned them into something from a nightmare. One man hung alone to one side, bent backward.
His mouth was wide open in a final scream at the spearhead that jutted 2 feet upward from his belly. The remains of what looked like a stretcher of sorts, possibly improvised out of backpack frames, lay beneath him. At the shadowy base of the pit, she could just make out the dome of a skull and the multiple arches of a rib cage protruding from ancient drifted dust. The members of the missing Chinese archaeology team were not the first victims. Anya looked up. She had fallen only a couple of yards below the pit's lip. The sword had entered the wall blade vertical. It flexed only slightly under her weight. She knew it could break, but it didn't seem strained at the moment. Unwilling to test it any longer than she had to, she swung back and forth experimentally, gaining momentum. Then she launched her legs back and up. As soon as she let go of it, the sword vanished into the otherwhere. Whatever kind of graceful landing she was hoping for didn't happen. Her legs and hips flopped up onto the floor. Her head and upper torso swung over empty space, and the waiting bronze spearheads. As her body started to topple forward, she got her hands on the rim of the pit and halted herself. With something like revulsion, she threw herself backward, sprawling on her butt and elbows. Then she just lay like that a while and breathed deeply.
Well, that got the old adrenaline pumping.
Anya slowly got to her feet. The trapdoor swung over and began to settle back to the appearance of a normal, innocuous stretch of floor. As it eclipsed the beam of her lost lamp, shining up from the pit like hellfire, she reached up to switch on her headlamp. Its reassuring yellow glow sprang out as the glare was cut off. It wasn't very powerful. The darkness seemed to flood around the narrow beam with a palpable weight and presence.
It'll be enough. It has to be.
Putting her back to the left-hand wall, she edged down the corridor. The dust, which had settled in the past few weeks, hiding the doomed expedition's footsteps, had been dumped into the pit, except for a certain quantity that still swirled in the air and rasped her lungs like sandpaper. The clean patch of floor, limned by the white light shining from below, made its end obvious. Cautiously, she moved the rest of the way down the corridor toward the green door. No more traps tried to grab her. As she'd suspected, the door was bronze. It had a stylized dragon embossed on it, the ancient symbol of imperial might. She hesitated. She saw no obvious knob or handle. Reaching into her pocket for a tissue to cover her hand, she pushed on the door. It swung inward stiffly. She had to put her weight behind it before it opened fully. A great wash of cool air swept over her. Surprisingly, it lacked the staleness she would have expected from a tomb sealed for 2.5 millennia. Bending low, she stepped inside. The tomb of Mad Emperor Lu was almost anticlimactic. It was a simple, domed space, 20 yards in diameter, rising to 10 at the apex, through which a hole about a yard wide opened through smooth, polished stone. Anya wondered if it had been intended to allow the Emperor's spirit to depart the burial chamber. Dust covered the floor, a good 4 inches deep, so that it swamped Anya's shoes. In the midst of the dust pond stood a catafalque, 4 feet high and wide, 8 feet long. On it lay an effigy in what appeared to be moldering robes, long cobwebbed and gone the color of the dust that had mounded over it, half obscuring it. A second mound rose suggestively by the feet. Anya dug her digital camera from her pack and snapped several photos, moving forward as cautiously as she could through the dust. As an archaeologist, her reflex was to disturb things as little as possible, but that wasn't the reason for her deliberation. She was more worried about stirring a cloud of blinding dust and more traps. She reached the foot of the bier. On closer inspection, the reclining figure seemed to be a mummy rather than an effigy. Anya presumed it was the man himself, Emperor Lu. It still gave her a shiver to be in the presence of such a mythic figure, however dead and desiccated he might be.
This just isn't right.
Anya felt sorrow and anger that this corpse, this priceless relic, would soon be left to decay to nothing in the waters of a new lake. She forced herself to snap some more shots, always being careful where she put her feet in case there were more inventive booby traps waiting to be sprung. But Lou seemed to have no more surprises up his decaying sleeves. There was actually little here to reward a tomb robber clever enough to get this far, except perhaps that mound by the mummy's feet. Anya finished recording Lou for posterity and knelt by the foot of the bier. The mound was about as wide as a dinner plate and 4 or 5 inches high. Gently, Anya brushed dust away with her hands. In a moment, she uncovered the artifact, a beautiful circular seal of milky green jade, 6 inches wide and a good inch thick, engraved with the figure of a sinuous dragon. It was Lou's imperial seal, beyond doubt. Anya's heart caught in her throat.
Bingo!
Reverently, she reached out and touched it. The green stone was smooth as a water-polished pebble. It was hard, yet seemed to have some sort of give, as if it were a living thing and not a carved stone artifact. The workmanship was exquisite. Each of the toes on the dragon's feet was clearly visible, and the characters inscribed around it stood in clear relief. To hold such an object in her hand was itself a reward, reminding her, half guiltily, how abundantly she would have earned her commission. A flicker of motion tugged at her peripheral vision. Anya turned. Emperor Lu was sitting up on his bier. The shriveled face with its empty eye sockets looked angry. For a moment she crouched there, clutching the jade and staring at its moldering owner like a deer caught in the headlights. And then a great deluge of water gushed out of the ceiling, drowning the mummy and knocking Anya sprawling. She was washed toward the bronze door on a torrent of glutinous mud. For a moment, the wildly spiraling beam of her headlamp illuminated the mummy. It sat there on its catafalque in the midst of the stream, as if taking a shower. The jaw had fallen open. She could clearly see. It was as if Lou laughed at her, enjoying his final joke on the woman who had despoiled his tomb. Then the water obscured her sight of him. She managed to get onto her feet against the rushing torrent. She scrambled out with the water sloshing around her shins. Out of options and the rising water, Anya ran for all she was worth. The quick death of tripping some ancient spear trap seemed infinitely preferable to being trapped down here to drown in the dark. She vaulted the hinged floor trap, still outlined in thin white lines of light, without hesitation. The long jump wasn't quite good enough. The floor pivoted heart-wrenchingly beneath her feet. Adrenaline fueled a second frantic leap that carried her to safety. She raced up the steeper tunnel. The water followed her right up the ramp. Anya wondered why the passageway wasn't fatally flooded already. That made her run the faster. Her light swung wildly before her. Spears leaped from the wall to Anya's left. The green bronze heads crashed into the far wall behind her back. Up through the tunnels, Anya raced. When she dared risk a glance back over her shoulder, she saw water surging after her like a monster made of froth. No way was groundwater rising this far this fast, she thought. The valley was clearly flooding a lot quicker than she had been assured it would. So now she was racing the waters rising outside the mound as well as those within. From time to time, side passages joined the main corridor. In her haste, she missed the one that led to the entrance she had come in, which was not at the mound's absolute apex. She only realized her error when she came into a hemispherical chamber at what must have been the actual top. A hole in the ceiling let in vague, milky light from an overcast sky. Anya stopped. For the first time, she realized she still clutched the Imperial Seal in a death grip. The expedition wasn't a total write-off.
Provided I live.
Forcing herself to straighten, she looked up at the hole. It was small. She guessed she could get through, but only just. She would never pass while she wore her day pack, and she wasn't going to risk wriggling through with the seal in a cargo pocket. The fit was tight enough it would almost certainly break.
Damn!
She swung off her pack, wrapping the seal in a handkerchief. She stuck it in a Ziploc bag she had brought for protecting artifacts. She stowed it carefully in her pack and set off back down the corridor to find the real way out. She was stopped within a few steps. The water had caught her and was surging upward. The valley was flooding fast.
Oh, double damn!
She ran back up to the apex chamber and cupped her hands around her mouth.
Hello? Can you hear me? I need a little help here!
Anya didn't hold out much hope. The pilot and co-pilot would be sitting in the cockpit with both engines running. In fact, Anya had no particularly good reason to believe they hadn't already flown away.
Hello down there! I'll lend you a hand.
Anya stared at the hole for a moment, although she could see nothing but gray cloud. She had no idea who her rescuer was.
Hello? I'm throwing down a rope.
A pale blue nylon line uncoiled from the ceiling. Anya looked nervously back over her shoulder at the chamber's entrance, thinking about the rising water.
I've got a pack. It's got important artifacts in it. Extremely delicate. I'll have to ask you to pull the pack up first. I can't fit through the hole while carrying it.
Very well. Tie it home, and I'll pull it up straight away.
Anya did so.
Okay, pull it up!
The pack rose rapidly toward the ceiling. Anya frowned, but the woman slowed it down when it neared the top. She extracted it without its synthetic fabric touching the sides of the hole.
Thanks! Good job!
After an anxious moment, the rope came through the ceiling again. Except, not far enough. Not nearly far enough. Anya reckoned she could just barely brush it with her fingertips if she jumped as high as she could. She could never get a grip on it.
Hey! I'm afraid it's not far enough! I need a little more rope here!
So sorry! No can do!
What do you mean? You're not gonna leave me to drown!
Of course not! In a matter of a very few minutes, the water will rise enough to float you up to where you can grasp the rope and climb up. A bit damp, perhaps, but none the worse for wear.
Anya stared. The astonishing words actually distracted her from the floodwaters until they rose above the tops of her waterproof shoes and sloshed inside them.
Oh, at least leave me my pack!
I'm afraid not. You have to understand, Lindsay. There are two ways to do things. The hard way and the easy way.
Easy? Not easy, Anguenya!
Say, farewell, Audrey!
No!
Anya stared. The chill water reached her knees. She stood, utterly overwhelmed by the realization that she had just been victimized by the world's most notorious tomb robber.
You're kidding. Who doesn't like the Eiffel Tower?
Rue regarded Anya from beneath a critically arched white brow.
Bah, it is an excrescence.
Right. So you were happier when your only reason to look up in the sky was to avoid chamber pots being emptied on your head from the upper stories?
Ah, you moderns. You have lost touch with your natures. Back in those days, we appreciated simple pleasures.
Not including hygiene.
You display a most remarkably crabbed attitude for an antiquarian.
I study the period. I'm fascinated by the period. But I don't romanticize it. I know way too much about it for that. I wouldn't want to live in the Renaissance.
There is something to this progress, I do not deny. But often, I miss the old days.
And you've plenty of old days to miss.
That was, if anything, an understatement. When Rue spoke about the Renaissance, he did so from actual experience. Rue was dressed like what he was, an extremely wealthy old man in an elegantly tailored dove gray suit and a white straw hat, his white hair and beard considerably more neatly barbered than his ferocious brows. Anya set down her cup. She sat with her elbows on the metal mesh tabletop, fingers interlaced and chin propped on the backs of her hands. She wore a sweater over her well-worn blue jeans. A pair of sunglasses was pushed up onto the front of her hair, which she wore in a ponytail. Autumn had begun to bite. The leaves on the trees along the Seine were turning yellow around the edges, and the air was tinged with a hint of wood smoke. But here in Paris, the sidewalks and their attendant cafes were thronged by Parisians eager to absorb all the sun's heat they could before winter settled in.
I'm still miffed at what happened in Ningxia.
You're miffed. I have had to answer to certain creditors after the shortfall in our accounts, which was caused by your incompetence, need I remind you?
No, and that's not true. I got the seal. I had it in my hands.
Unfortunately, it failed to stay in your hands, dear child.
That wasn't my fault!
You trusted a strange voice which called down to you through a hole in the ground. And you style yourself a skeptic, no?
I didn't really have a choice.
Really? But did you not eventually save yourself by following that vexatious young lady's suggestion and waiting until the water floated you high enough so you could climb the rest of the way out?
Only to find the witch had flown off in my helicopter. My helicopter!
Oh, come down. She did send a boat for you. which she paid for herself.
Anya sat back and tightly folded her arms. The tomb robber had even left her pack. Without the seal.
That just added insult to injury. Yeah, whose side are you on, anyway?
My own, of course. Why be mad at me? I only point out things could have gone much worse. You might have seen Miss Isi Unguenia's famous trademark pistols, for example.
True. For a moment, Anya sat and marinated in her misery.
It's just losing such an artifact. The only trace of that tomb to a plunderer like Isi Unguenia. Now it's personal.
Rue set down his cup and leaned forward.
Enough of this. Now listen. Your secret career is an expensive indulgence.
Which I never volunteered for in the first place.
Ah, details. The fact is, you have been burning money. As I have alluded to, certain creditors grow insistent.
You haven't been borrowing from Garin again.
It's possible.
Garin Braden was a fabulously wealthy playboy. He was also Rue's former protege, and he feared the miraculous reforging of the sword threatened his eternal life.
We must improve what you Americans charmingly call cash flow.
Tell me.
Somewhere in the mountainous jungles of Southeast Asia, there supposedly lies a vast and ancient temple complex. Within it hides a priceless artifact. A golden elephant idol with emerald eyes. I have been approached by a wealthy collector who wants it enough to pay most handsomely.
Who?
One who treasures anonymity.
That's a promising start. So I take it all this mystery likewise precludes your at least running a credit check?
Sadly, yes. However, our client...
Let's hold off on this our business until I'm actually signed on, shall we?
Our client has offered a handsome preliminary payment, as well as an advance against expenses.
The preliminary, at least, needs to be no strings attached.
Rue raised his eyebrow again.
What?
That would require substantial faith on the client's part.
So? Either he, she, it has faith in me or doesn't. If they're not willing to believe in my integrity, then to heck with it. And why come to me anyway if that's the case? If I'm not honest, there's 10 dozen ways I could chisel, from embezzling the expense account to selling to the highest bidder whatever it is this mystery guest wants me to get. There isn't any guarantee I could give that could protect against that. If I'm a crook, what's my guarantee worth?
Rue looked as if he were bursting to respond. She glared him into silence.
While we're on the subject, there's not going to be any accounting for expenses incurred. For reasons I really hope you won't make me explain out loud.
You don't ask for much, my dear child. Beyond the sun, the moon, and perhaps the stars.
Just one or two. Anyway, I'm the one taking all the risks. You should be happy to ask for the best no-money-back terms available.
I don't want to scare the client off.
This strikes me as skirting pretty close to pot hunting. The Jade Seal affair already came too close.
But you've done similar things in the past. And after all, who better to ensure the golden elephant is recovered in a sensitive way, rather than ripped from the earth by a tomb robber? Or would you prefer to leave the field open to, say, the likes of Her Highness, Isi Unguenia?
Quit with the psychological manipulation.
Tea, Miss Creed?
The bluff and jovial old Englishman with the big pink face, a brush of white hair, and a red vest straining slightly over his paunch, held up a white porcelain teapot with flowers painted on it.
Thank you, Sir Sidney.
Anya started to rise from the floral upholstered chair. Sir Sidney Hazelton gestured her to stay seated. He poured the tea with brisk precision, then brought her the cup with an air of great solicitude.
Thank you.
Sir Sidney reseated himself in his overstuffed chair.
Really, isn't this notion of lost cities or temples more romantic than realistic? I mean, what with all these satellites and surveillance aircraft and such today?
It's a matter of who pays attention to what image. Not everyone who runs across overhead imaging of, say, a lost temple has the knowledge to recognize what they're looking at. And many of the most skilled image analysts are looking for military information, not ancient ruins. Although some pretty astonishing ruins have been discovered by overhead photography just in the last couple of decades.
So I gather. Well, I must say it does a body good to believe there's still some mystery left in this old world of ours. Quite bracing, actually.
Aren't you the leading expert in lost treasures and fabled ruins?
My dear, the operative word there is fabled. I am, as you know, a cultural anthropologist. Specifically, I'm a mythologist. I study the phenomena of myths, particularly pertaining to myths about lost treasures. But there's very little more exciting than the possibility a myth turns out to be true.
That's how I feel about it. And there's a very definite possibility the trail I'm on might lead to a myth being confirmed.
If I can be of any assistance to a lovely young woman such as yourself.
He paused to pour more tea and stir in plenty of milk.
I've got to thank you again for sharing your time with me.
Oh, nonsense, nonsense. The pleasure is mine. I am retired, after all. It's not as if there are abundant claims upon my time these days. My partner of many years died last year. It was quite sudden.
I'm sorry.
I'm sure you had nothing to do with it, my dear. I can't say I've grown comfortable with it, or ever shall, I fancy. Doubtless I've not that long left in which to do so. I've seen enough old chums put into the ground to have few illusions on that score.
Sir Sidney leaned forward.
But I doubt that I will be shuffling off this mortal coil within the very near future, so suppose you tell me this myth you're trying to pin down.
After a moment's pause, Anya did. She shared such scanty information as Rue had provided, plus a few not very helpful details from a file he had subsequently emailed her. Sir Sidney sat listening and nodding. Then he smiled and sat back.
The golden elephant. So you've reason to believe that it is real?
You've heard of it?
Yes. Oh, please, don't get your hopes up quite yet. Just let me think a moment. See what I can recall which might prove of use. Do you mind if I smoke my pipe?
No.
Sir Sidney produced a pipe from an inner pocket, took up tobacco and various arcane tools from a silver tray on the table next to him.
I'm a bit puzzled by one aspect of this.
His pipe smoke had a sweet but not cloying smell.
I thought Southeast Asia was mostly Buddhist.
Quite.
Not that I know much about Asian mythology, but I'd associate elephants with the Hindu god Ganesha, rather than anything Buddhist.
Sir Sidney smiled. Blue-white smoke wreathed his big, benign pink features.
Ah, but elephants are most significant beasts in all of Asia. Not just big and imposing creatures, but economically important. It needn't surprise us too much that the elephant occupies a role in Buddhist symbolism. You see, Buddhists envision what they call the seven jewels of royal power. These constitute the attributes of earthly kingship. One of these jewels is the precious elephant. It represents a calm, majestic mind. A useful trait in a king, although one honored more in the breach than in the observance, as it were.
If Asian history is anything like that of Renaissance Europe, that's probably an understatement.
They spoke a while longer. Anya enjoyed the old man's conversation, but she increasingly felt restless.
Are you remembering any more about the myths regarding our fabulous golden elephant?
It's said to have emeralds for eyes.
Well, that sounds like my elephant.
Don't put it in your vest pocket yet, my dear. I'm not dredging up much from the murky depths of my poor old brain, but I recall hints of travelers' tales. Even reports from a certain scientific expedition from early this... in the 20th century. I find it most disconcerting to refer to the 20th century as the last century. It may not strike you so, of course.
It does strike me a little odd sometimes that there are people capable of holding intelligible conversations who were born in the 21st century. I guess that means I'm getting old.
Not at all, my dear. I dare say, I don't think you'll ever grow old. Oh, I am sorry. I suppose that could be misconstrued, couldn't it? I didn't mean you won't enjoy a long and happy life. What I meant to convey was that however many your years, I anticipate that your outlook will remain youthful. For that matter, I don't doubt the years will lie less heavily on you than me, in any event. By all appearances, you keep yourself in far better shape than I ever did.
Sir Sidney patted himself on the paunch. Anya looked studiously down into her tea and tried hard not to read her future there.
But I see I've gone and spoiled your mood. Forgive a clumsy old man's musings.
No apologies needed. Do you have any suggestions how I can track down this expedition you mentioned?
His big pink face creased thoughtfully. At last, he shook his head.
It eludes me for the moment. I'll see what I can dig up. In the meantime, I do have a next step to suggest to you.
What's that?
Why, visit that great repository of arcane archaeological knowledge, the British Museum, and see what you can turn up.
I'll do that. Thank you so much.
It's nothing. Indeed, almost literally. Doubtless you've thought of the museum already. It's right down the lane and across the Tottenham Court Road, you know.
Yes. Thank you, Sir Sidney. You've encouraged me. Really, if nothing else, I know I'm not the only one with fantasies about an emerald-eyed gold elephant.
Anya stood.
Don't get up, please. I can let myself out. You've got my card. Please call me if you think of anything. With your permission, I'll check back with you in a day or so.
It would be my pleasure.
On impulse, she went and kissed him on the forehead. Then, collecting her umbrella from the stand by the door, an antique elephant's foot, she noted with amusement, she walked out of his flat into the rainy street. About mid-afternoon, Anya pushed herself back from the flat-screen monitor. She stretched, trying to do so as unobtrusively as possible. Her upper back felt as if it had big rocks in it. She had spent a frustrating afternoon in the Paul Hamlin Library, flipping through catalogs and skimming through semi-random volumes. She caught a whiff from the digitized pages of British Archaeology for Fall 1921, which mentioned the Cahoon Expedition of 1899 to what was then Siam. But when she tracked down the details, including Cahoon's journals and his report to the Explorers Club, he made nary a mention of gold elephants, with or without emerald eyes. Anya shook her head. Certain needs were asserting themselves, not least among them, the need to be up and moving. Checking her watch, Anya reckoned she had plenty of time for a turn through the Joseph E. Hotung Gallery, which held the Asian collections, before returning to her labors. She'd try the reading room next and see if her luck improved. The library jutted out to flank the main museum entrance from Great Russell Street. She emerged into the great court. The ceiling was high, translucent white, crisscrossed by what she took for a geodesic pattern of bracework, springing from a stout white cylindrical structure that dominated the center of the space. The cylinder housed the new reading room. The sterile style, which put her in mind of a 70s science fiction movie, contrasted jarringly with the pseudo-Greek porticoed walls and their Dorian capitaled pilasters. The court wasn't crowded. A few sullen gaggles of schoolchildren in drab uniforms, some tourists snapping enthusiastically with digital cameras, were watched by security guards more sullen than the children. She was vaguely surprised photography was allowed. A sudden flurry of movement tugged at her peripheral vision. A female figure was strutting through the room. Anya got the impression of a rounded, muscle-taut form in a dark blue jacket and knee-length skirt. Black hair jutted out in a kinky cloud behind the woman's head, bound by an amber band. Anya had never seen the woman in the flesh, but she had seen plenty of pictures on the internet, especially in the wake of her recent China adventure.
Easy on Gwenya.
She felt anger start to seethe. She turned to follow. Without looking back, the young African woman continued through the hall into the next room, which housed Indian artifacts. She moved purposefully. Her head was up, her broad shoulders back. She was shorter by a head than Anya, who nonetheless found herself pressed to keep pace. Anya felt uncharacteristically unsure how to proceed, Her rival could not have gotten her famous twin Sphinx auto pistols through the museum metal detectors if she had even dared bring them into Britain. Easy Unguenya made up Anya's mind for her by stopping to peer into an exhibit case a few yards ahead of her.
I'm practically committed now anyway.
The younger woman studied an exquisite jade carving of an elephant in an elaborate headdress, standing with trunk raised to bedangled forehead. Anya felt a jolt.
Could she be here for the same reason I am?
Anya dismissed the idea. A collector would hardly recruit a tomb robber as notorious as Unguenya. Anya came up on Easy's left.
Anya Creed.
The younger woman didn't look around. Anya realized Easy must have seen her approach in the glass.
What a delightful surprise to encounter you here.
A surprise, anyway. After the way you marooned me on that tomb mound in the middle of a rising lake.
Did the boat I sent back for you not reach you? You must have had an unpleasant swim. Not my intention, I assure you.
The boat came. That's not the point. I'm placing you under citizen's arrest.
Unguenya turned. Anya was struck by just how young the tomb robber was. She was in her 20s, but looked 15. Anya was also struck by just how pretty Easy was. Unguenya occasionally did modeling, not always fully dressed.
Why, whatever would you arrest me for?
You have committed countless violations of international law regarding traffic in antiquities. As you well know,
you'd already looted the seal from the feet of Mad Emperor Lu. Congratulations on getting past the booby traps, by the way.
I had official permission. I had all the proper paperwork.
And so did I. Remarkable how easy such things are to come by for those willing to be generous to underappreciated civil servants.
It's not like it was an isolated incident. So come with me.
You can't be serious. There are people here. Behave yourself, Ms. Creed.
I told you. You're under citizen's arrest.
Do you think such an archaic legal concept still has force? This is a country where someone who successfully resists a violent assault is likely to face brisker prosecution and longer jail terms than their attacker.
When Scotland Yard gets your Interpol file, they probably won't be too concerned with the niceties of how you wound up in their custody, then will they?
Oh, this is completely absurd.
To Anya's astonishment, the young woman turned and walked away. Before Anya could respond, Easy had pushed through into a stairway to the upper level. Frowning, Anya followed. Easy trotted upstairs. Her pace was brisk, but it definitely wasn't flight.
Aren't you cocky?
Just shy of the upper floor landing, she grabbed Easy's right arm from behind. It felt impressively solid.
Not so fast.
Easy turned and torqued her arm out of Anya's grasp. Her left elbow came around to knock Anya's arm away, and she thrust a short right spear hand straight for Anya's solar plexus. Anya anticipated the attack. She bent forward slightly while turning to her right. Easy's fingers jabbed into Anya's ribs. Mindful of surveillance cameras, Anya straightened, trying at the same time to deliver a hook upward into Unguenya's ribs. The blow bounced off Easy's left elbow and sent another white spike of pain up Anya's arm.
Really, Ms. Creed, this is most unseemly.
After a brief exchange, barely visible to the high-mounted camera, Easy Unguenya sidestepped a short punch, reached with her right hand, and caught Anya behind the left elbow. She squeezed. It was as if a jolt of electricity had clenched her whole body in a spasm, dropped her to her knees, and left her there, lungs empty of breath and unable to draw one. Her vision swam.
Oh, dear. Are you quite all right, miss? I'll go and get help.
Easy trotted away up the stairs. Anya rocked back and forth. Darkness crowded in around the edges of her vision.
What's wrong with me?
It was as if she was suffering a giant whole body cramp. Slowly, the awful muscle spasm began to relax. She slumped. She was just regaining control of herself when two uniformed guards, a man and a woman, came down the steps.
Miss, are you all right?
Anya nodded and let them help her to her feet. She didn't have much choice. She still didn't have the muscular strength to stand on her own.
I'm fine, really. Thank you. It's past now.
The two guards exchanged a look.
Are you sure you don't need medical help?
No, I'm fine. Did you see which way my friend went?
No. She seemed very determined that we help you right away. She was quite the little package. It was too bad we had to rush away.
Oh, that's so sexist. I've half a mind to report you for that.
While the guards were distracted, Anya set off at what she hoped was a steady-looking pace, up the stairs to the next level. She made it through the door before she wobbled and had to lean back against it for a moment to gather herself. Her vision expanded, slowly but steadily. She no longer felt as if she were passing through a tunnel toward a white light. She managed to walk briskly, with barely a wobble, through a door into a wider hall. Another set of stairs led down. Anya set her jaw. The stairs descended to the ground level, and then to the north exit. She found herself outside on broad steps, with Montague Place in front of her, and the pseudo-classical facade of the White Wing behind. The cool air revived her somewhat. A light rain began to tickle Anya's face. Passers-by glanced at her, then walked quickly on.
Calm down. This doesn't always happen. She's got the better of you twice. That's not statistically significant.
For a time, she walked at random, lost in thoughts that whirled amid the noise of the city center. Anya stopped at a little cafe inside a glass front of some looming office building for a cup of hot tea. Sitting on an uncomfortable metal chair, she gulped it as quickly as she could without scalding her lips. Outside, she was surprised to see that twilight was well along. Gloom just coalesced atom by atom out of the gray that pervaded the cold heart of the city. Setting the cup down, she strode out into the early autumn evening. Anya headed toward Sir Sidney's, a dozen or so blocks away. Maybe he'd turned something up. It always amazed Anya how many little alcoves and cul-de-sacs there were in downtown London. Sir Sidney lived on a little half-block street, narrow and lined with trees, whose leaves had already turned gray, brown, and dead. It was so tiny and insignificant, barely more than an alley, it didn't seem to rate its own spy cameras. Trotting up the steps to the door of Sir Sidney's red brick flat, Anya wondered how his aging knees held up to them. Before she could carry the thought any further, she noticed the white door with the shiny brass knob stood slightly ajar. She stopped in mid-step. Her body temperature seemed to drop 20 degrees.
It's all right. He's old. He might be getting absent-minded. Just nipped out and forgot to fully close the door.
Trying not to act like a burglar, she went on up the steps.
Sir Sidney?
Putting a hand in the pocket of her windbreaker, she pushed the door open and stepped quickly inside. The entrance hallway was dark, as was the sitting room to her right. Nonetheless, the last gloom of day through the door and filtering in through curtained windows showed her the shape of Sir Sidney lying on his back on the floor. The rich burgundy of the throw rug on which he had fallen had been overtaken by a deeper, spreading stain. Anya knelt briefly at the old man's side. The skin of his neck was cold. She felt no pulse. Moving as if through a fog, Anya took stock of the sitting room. The floor was scattered with toppled furniture, strewn papers mingled with artifacts. Sir Sidney had welcomed his murderer, or murderers. There was no sign of forced entry, but he had not died easily. Not far from the body lay a 2-foot-high brass statue of Shakyamuni. The screen behind the seated figure was bent. The heavy metal object was smeared with blood. Anya looked away. She had seen too much death in her short life. An overturned swivel chair drew her attention to the roll-top writing desk. Briskly, she moved to it. She had little time. She racked her brain, trying to remember if there had been anybody in the short, tree-lined lane who might have seen her enter the flat. On the desk, an old-fashioned, spiral-bound notebook lay open. Anya almost smiled. She would have been surprised if the old scholar had kept his notes on a computer, but to her chagrin, the first page was blank. Frowning, she started to move on. Then she turned back and leaned close to study the page in the poor and failing light. With quick precision, she tore the page away, folded it neatly, and stuck it in her pocket. Anya paused by the body. She made herself look down and see what Sir Sidney had suffered. It had been because of her, she knew. The laws of coincidence could be tortured only so far.
I'm sorry, Sir Sidney. I will find whoever did this.
Already a deep anger had begun to burn toward Easy Anguena. Could her presence in the museum that afternoon possibly have been coincidence?
and I will punish them.
She quickly left the flat. When Anya was back in her hotel room, the sorrow overtook her. Suddenly, but hardly unexpectedly. She wept bitterly for a kind and helpful old man she had barely known, and for her own role in bringing about his death. She didn't try to fight it, otherwise it would distract her. When her eyes were dry and her mind calm again, she took out the notepaper, ruled in faint blue lines, unfolded it under the lamp on the writing desk, and examined it closely. The neat curls and swoops of the old scholar's precise hand were engraved by the pressure of the pen that had written on the page above it. Among the tools of the trade she carried with her were a sketch pad and graphite pencil. Extending the soft lead and brushing it across the sheet of paper, Anya was pleased when the writing appeared, white on gray. She bit her lip.
Not what I hoped. Not at all.
The lights inside the tunnel striped the window next to Anya in the Eurostar passenger car. Anya placed her fingertips against the cool glass of the window. It was still streaked on the outside with rain from the storm that had hit London as it moved out, well before it headed into the tunnel beneath the English Channel. The weather fit her mood. The notebook page, burned in the hotel room sink to ashes Anya had disposed of, crumpled in a napkin in a public trash can on the street, hadn't held the key to the mystery of the golden elephant, as Anya hoped. But Sir Sidney's memory, and perhaps a little research, had unearthed what could prove to be a clue. The Antiquities of Indochina, Hazelton had written. It appeared to be the title of a book or monograph, since beside it he had written a name, Duquesne. He had either done a bit of digging on his own or called friends. Without checking his phone records, she'd never know. Given her contacts in the cyber underworld, it was possible, but she didn't want to risk tying herself to the case. Perhaps he'd simply remembered. In any event, after jotting down a few grocery items, he had written Sorbonne only. The word only was deeply outlined several times. It was the only lead she had, but the murderers also had that lead. If Sir Sidney's murder had been discovered by authorities, it hadn't made it to the news by the time she boarded the train in the St. Pancras station. Quite close, ironically, both to Sir Sidney's flat and the British Museum. She'd bought passage under the identity of a Brit headed on holiday on the continent.
Rue was right, as usual.
This business was expensive. She hoped the commission from this mysterious collector would cover it. She grimaced then. Nothing would pay for Sir Sidney's death. No money, anyway. Her resolve to bring retribution on his killer or killers had set like concrete, and she felt, perhaps irrationally, she had a good idea who at least one of them was. Cold-blooded murder had never seemed part of Easy Unguenya's repertoire before, but perhaps greed had caused her to branch out. Anya only wondered how the tomb robber could have learned about her quest. Unless their encounter in the museum, just that day, although it seemed a lifetime ago, was pure coincidence. Oxford-educated, Unguenya kept a house in London. She was known to spend a fair amount of time there, and given she really was a scholar of some repute, it wasn't at all unlikely she'd find herself in the British Museum on a semi-regular basis at least. But Anya had a hard time buying it.
So, you work for an American television program, Miss Creed?
The curator was a trim, tiny Asian woman with a gray, dusted bun of dark hair piled behind her head and a very conservative gray suit. Anya guessed she must be Vietnamese.
Well, that's right, Madame Duval. It's called Chasing History's Monsters.
The woman's already small mouth almost disappeared in a grimace of disapproval.
I'm the voice of reason on a show which, I'm afraid, sometimes runs to the sensational.
Why, precisely, do you seek credentialing to the University of Paris system, Ms. Creed?
The University of Paris, commonly known as the Sorbonne, after the Commune's 750-year-old college, was actually a collection of 13 autonomous but affiliated universities. Anya stood talking with the assistant curator for the whole system in the highly modernized offices of University One, Panthéon Sorbonne, one of the four modern universities located in the actual Sorbonne complex itself. If accepted as a legitimate scholarly researcher, she would gain access to collections throughout the system, even those normally closed to the public.
Whenever possible, I like to combine what I call my proper academic pursuits with my work for the show. As an archaeologist, I specialize in medieval and Renaissance documents in Romance languages. The predominant language, of course, being French.
The woman smiled, if tightly. She was definitely warming.
I have a particular interest in the witch trials of the Renaissance.
Anya knew she gained some credibility because she showed she knew when the real bulk of the witch prosecutions took place. Most people, including way too many college professors, thought they were a phenomenon of the Middle Ages. Still, the woman stiffened again, ever so slightly.
I am particularly interested in the notion that the church might have had some justification for its actions in the matter, notwithstanding their methods for dealing with the problem. It is possible that there existed a sort of witch culture that posed a real and deliberate threat to the church, instead of the whole thing being a sort of mass hysteria, as is mostly assumed these days.
Everything she said was true in the most legalistic and technical sense. There were such notions. They interested Anya.
That appears to me to be a perfectly legitimate course of study. If you will come with me, young lady, we will begin the paperwork to provide you the proper credentials.
Thank you.
4 hours later, Anya's vision was practically swimming. She was accustomed to deciphering fairly arcane writing. The Antiquities of Indochina was printed in a near-microscopic font. Unfortunately, unlike her internet browsers, Anya's eyes didn't come with a handy zoom feature. The early 20th century French itself was no problem. It was just hard to see. Her heart jumped as she made out the words.
The 1913 German expedition to Southeast Asia turned up many marvels indeed. Its reports included a fabulous hilltop temple complex hidden in the reclaiming arms of the jungle with the breathtaking golden idol of an elephant in its midst.
The passage then went on to talk about rubber production in Hanoi Province in what was now Vietnam.
Wait.
The outburst drew glares from other researchers in the reading room. Anya glared back until they dropped their eyes back to tomes and computer screen. Then she returned her attention to the book. The crisp evening air felt good and smelled of roasting chestnuts. Anya was hungry, walking the summit of Montmartre with her hands jammed in her jacket pockets and her chin sunk into the collar. Over her left shoulder loomed the white domes of the Sacré-Cœur Basilica. The days of the Moulin Rouge and other noted or notorious cabarets were long gone. The fashionable night spots had long since migrated down across the river to the left bank and city center. Nowadays, the area was given over to generic discos, artist studios, and souvenir and antique shops, most of which were closed in the early evening. Anya had found a fairly deserted section of the windy, narrow streets winding gradually down the hill. That suited her mood. The one reference to the 1913 German expedition had been it. Not just for the book, but for everything else she'd been able to check of the University of Paris's collection until they booted her out of the reading room at 7:30. The good news was that she now knew where the stories of a golden elephant statue in a vast, lost temple came from. The bad news was, that wasn't much to go on. It hadn't been enough to lead to any more information, at least so far. The various archaeological reviews and journals from the period she had read stayed resolutely mute concerning any such expedition. She would have thought there'd be some mention. Walking along, she wondered if chauvinism might have come into play. The Great War, as it was then known, broke out a year or so after the expedition. Indeed, if it set forth in 1913, the expedition might well have still been in progress when the First World War began. And in 1913, the French were still grumpy over the Franco-Prussian War. So it struck her as possible that mention of German expeditions might have been censored in French journals. But scientists of the day still would have considered themselves above such political disputes. Wars came and went. Science endured. Anya turned down a quaintly cobbled alley between steel-shuttered storefronts that reminded her of home in Brooklyn. She considered two main possibilities. One, that the expedition simply got lost in the shuffle of World War I.
And two, that it was all just rumor.
That made her bare her teeth in dismay. Scientific anthropology and archaeology were rife with such speculations in the wake of Schliemann's discovery of Troy, or a reasonable facsimile thereof. So the whole golden elephant yarn could just be the product of a hyperactive imagination. Then Anya had to entertain a third possibility, that there was indeed such an expedition, and the only mention of it that still existed anywhere on Earth was the sentence she had read in that book earlier in the day. She knew that was an all-too-real likelihood. Paris had famously been spared the ravages of World War II, but the expedition, of course, originated in Germany. The whole country had been handled pretty roughly. And most artifacts went through Berlin, which, between relentless bombing and the Red Army's European tour, had pretty much been destroyed. Every last journal or other scrap of writing relating to the 1913 expedition stood a good chance of having been burned up.
There she is!
Anya stopped. She set her mouth. She sensed at least two men behind her. She braced to run. Then, from the shadowed brickwork arch of an entry into a small garden courtyard she hadn't even noticed before, a third man strolled out into the starlight before her. She'd wandered, eyes wide open, into a classic trap.
What were you thinking?
What have we here?
The man who had appeared in front was a bit shorter than Anya, wearing a knit cap and a long dark cloth coat against the autumn chill. Anya looked around. The other two men came up on her left and right, winging out to the side. They were positioned to catch her no matter which way she might bolt.
Careful. She has long legs, that one. She could run fast.
They were very smooth, very tactical, coming on her from three directions, allowing her no options to escape. They radiated hardness. Her skill in martial arts, not to mention real fighting experience, gave her an edge on a single man if he underestimated her. These men almost certainly did. The first man stopped 2 yards from her. He seemed aware of the possibility of a long-legged kick.
Not a good thing for you, Missy, being out alone like this.
Thanks for the concern. Now, if you'll kindly step aside, I'll be on my way.
He pulled his head back on his neck like a turtle starting a retreat into its shell and blinked at her with slightly bulbous, pale eyes.
It is a spirited one we've got here.
Yeah, it's a damned shame.
Shut up.
Anya's blood chilled as the men flanking her each grabbed one of her arms. She was certain this was no mugging. Whoever these bad boys were, they weren't common criminals. They were talent. However, they were lax. They underestimated her, or they would have slammed her to the ground straight away. They figured sheer masculinity would control her as effectively as physical techniques. Anya waited for her moment. The movements of the man on her right suggested he was about to press a knife to her neck to complete her submission. She sagged away from him, letting the guy on her left suddenly take almost her whole body weight. The other was pulled off balance. Anya thrust her right leg straight out behind his and twisted her hips, sweeping his legs from under him and slamming him to the pavement. The other man clamped his right arm around her neck.
Ne jouez pas avec moi.
Anya jammed her thumb straight back into his mouth. He was too dumbfounded even to try to bite. Wishing she had long nails, Anya dug her fingers into his face with all her strength. Then she put her hip into his legs and threw him over her shoulder. He landed on the Parisian. Both went down in a tangle. The Algerian snapped himself to his feet in the classic martial arts move. That confirmed to Anya he was trouble, probably a trained, seasoned killer. Anya concentrated. Joan of Arc's sword became a reassuring weight in her hands. She barely felt any resistance as it slashed through the man's neck. The Parisian was back on his feet. The third man still thrashed around on the stones. He had managed to impale himself on his partner's blade when Anya threw him. The sensible thing now was for everyone to run away, but the Parisian wasn't having any of that. He launched himself in a rush straight for Anya. She met the man with a front thrust kick to the sternum. It wasn't the strongest kick, but it stopped him. It also sent Anya back 3 semi-controlled steps. The Parisian's eyes widened as he noticed the broadsword. Instead of doing the sensible thing, running, he jammed his hand beneath his coat in the direction of his left armpit. He wasn't fast enough. Anya's sword flashed. Blue eyes stared at her in shocked incomprehension. Blood sprayed from his left carotid artery, severed by the stroke, which had slashed through his collarbone and into his chest. His right hand, clutching a black 9mm Beretta pistol, fell to the street. The man Anya had thrown was quiet, his lifeblood spreading in a pool beneath him. She made the sword go away. Walking quickly down the hill, she turned into the first alley to her right and was gone.